This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. It was over 100 years ago that searching for fingerprints first became a routine part of a crime scene investigation. This hour, forensic research in bloodstain pattern analysis and underwater body decomposition. In the first half hour, Iowa State University engineer Daniel Attinger talks about his research for the U.S. Justice Department on bloodstain pattern analysis in crime scenes. Then, Tyler O'Brien of the University of Northern Iowa. O'Brien is a forensic anthropologist who specializes in studying the underwater decomposition of bodies. O'Brien has been a consultant for various law agencies in the Midwest. An hour of forensic research, not for the squeamish, after this news. I'm Ben Kiefer with River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Today you're listening to an encore edition of the program. It was over 100 years ago that searching for fingerprints first became a routine part of crime scene investigations. And since that time, interpreting the evidence left behind at crime scenes has, of course, improved dramatically, and it continues to. Now, at this point in the program, a note about what's to come. We want to talk about a field that is not exactly for the squeamish. So if you grow faint at the sight of, or more precisely, the talk of blood, this next conversation might not be for you. Joining me now is Daniel Attinger. Daniel Attinger is an associate professor of mechanical engineering at Iowa State University. Professor Attinger, Daniel, welcome to our program.
Thank you, Ben.
Now, you are working to advance a field, or an area of a field, in something that is called blood stain pattern analysis. What is it?
It's a forensic discipline that is typically used when there's been a bloody accident or a bloody crime. So the analyst, the person trained in bloodstain pattern analysis, comes to the scene and looks at the marks that are left on the walls, on the carpets, the bloodstains. And he documents the position, the shape of those stains, and then tries to make an interpretation and figure out three things. One is how did this happen? And the other is when did this happen? And the last thing is where the persons or the objects that generated the blood. So he tries to answer those three questions: how, where, and when, just by looking at those blood stains.
Mm-hmm. Can you give us an example of what you mean? Because I assume blood stain pattern analysis has been going on for some time, as long as there have been blood stains, but you're trying to further it. In what way?
Yeah, you're right. Bloodstain pattern analysis is pretty much as old as the world. If you read the Bible, there's the story of the two brothers. I believe their name is Cain and Abel.
Cain and Abel, yes.
Yeah, and there's one who's not so happy with his brother and ends up killing his brother. And when God asks the remaining brother, I think it's Cain, what did you do to your brother? He said, "Oh, nothing. He just got lost." And God is able to see that he has bloody hands, and from the blood that he sees on the hands, he understands that something horrible has happened.
What types of patterns can come about when some kind of accident happens, or when there is some sort of injury or a killing?
Yeah. So you could have a gunshot, and in that case, the stains are very small, and there are many stains, so it's like a mist. It looks like a pink coverage of the wall or the floor, and it's very hard to see the individual stains because they are so small. And if you have a beating or a stabbing, then you're going to start to see much larger stains with a bigger distance between those. They are typically a quarter inch in size. And you can have even larger stains if somebody has an open wound and the blood drips from that wound. Then you can have stains that are several inches. You can, of course, have a pool of blood. That would mean somebody has been lying on the floor and the blood has been accumulating in this pool. And that pool can easily be several inches across.
Mm-hmm. You said one of the things you're trying to determine is when. So what happens to blood over time that gives you the when answer?
Yes, and it's very interesting to see that you have stains that can dry in a millisecond, in a fraction of a second, for very small drops. And for a pool of blood, the pool can remain liquid for several days. So there's a whole range of stains that could be used to determine the very precise time of a crime. And I have colleagues who work on this problem, and they state that they might be this method might be more accurate than what is currently used, which is you measure the temperature of the body because the body is going to cool down and reach room temperature within a few hours.
What tells you, what evidence is there out there that blood stain analysis needs to be improved that is not as accurate as it might be?
In 2009, the U.S. National Research Council looked at the state of forensic sciences in its entirety. So not only bloodstain pattern analysis, but also fingerprints, gunshot residue, ballistics, and all those forensic disciplines. And they published in 2009 a report that was relatively critical to the state of those disciplines. And specifically for bloodstain pattern analysis, they said two things that were of great interest to me. The first one is they say bloodstain pattern analysis should be built on more solid scientific foundations given the complex nature of the fluid dynamics that is involved in this. And I have expertise in fluid dynamics, so that caught my attention. And the other thing they said is that the uncertainties associated with bloodstain pattern analysis are enormous. And that's also very important for me as a researcher, but also as a citizen, because I come from Switzerland, which is a democratic country. I live in the U.S., which is one of the most democratic countries. And I strongly believe that solid forensic sciences are one of the important pieces for a democratic society. Because if you're innocent, the last thing you want is be put in jail because you have a testimony by a forensic expert against you that is based on non-scientific principles. And also, if you live in a community, you want to make sure that the bad guys are put to jail. And for those two things, it's very important to have solid forensics disciplines and techniques and sciences.
I wonder if there's a case, a criminal case, a murder case in the past that you can point to where blood stains were incorrectly interpreted.
That's a good question. I've never been in court. I've heard that there were very strong arguments about bloodstains in the O.J. Simpson case.
Yes.
And there were some top experts of the disciplines that were arguing for and against O.J. And I believe one of the reasons O.J. was not put in jail is due to some of those arguments and the way they were received by the court.
If you just joined us, my guest is Daniel Attinger. He's an associate professor of mechanical engineering at Iowa State University. He studies and researches an area called bloodstain pattern analysis. I wonder, Daniel, if you've taken interest in a more recent case. You mentioned the O.J. case. Analysis of bloodstains has played a role, I understand, in the murder investigation and the charges against Oscar Pistorius. He's the double amputee runner who raced in the Olympics for South Africa. That's a case that's interested you, too?
Oh, yes, yes. What is very interesting is that it seems the bloodstain pattern analysis is key to the conviction or not of Pistorius. And it seems that the first expert who was on the case has modified the evidence by, I believe stepping on some of the bloodstains and destroying that evidence. And I think we are getting ahead of a very long battle of experts.
I understand that you and your research team, you're leading, you have the use of a three-year, $632,000 grant from the U.S. Department of Justice to take some of the uncertainty out of the analysis of bloodstain patterns. I wonder if, Daniel, you can give us some of the an idea of some of the experiments you'll be doing with this money or have been doing.
Sure. So we are working on answering the question where the drop comes from, where the blood comes from.
The origin of the blood.
Yeah. Because if you have many stains, let's say on the wall, it's interesting to try to figure out where the blood that created that spatter, that collection of stains, has been generated from. And if you look at the state of the art, the way analysts work, they look at the shape of the stains, and from the shape they can deduct the angle of the impact. Let me give you a simple example. If the stain is round, that means that the drop came normally to the wall at a 90-degree angle. But if the stain is an ellipse, that means that the drop came with an oblique trajectory to the wall. Does this make sense to you?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. But that's pretty much where the know-how, the current techniques, that's all they use. In other words, then they have to assume that the drops have traveled in straight lines towards the wall. In other words, they do not account for the curved trajectories that occur because of the influence of two things, one being gravity. You've certainly made the experience that if you throw a ball in the air, it's going to have a curved trajectory rather than a straight trajectory because gravity pulls it down. And the other is the friction of the air against the drop, which is technically called drag. So what my team is doing is trying to reconstruct those curved trajectories by taking into account gravity and drag so that we get a better estimate of where the blood source was. So in other words, was the guy standing or sitting when the crime occurred? And then we can confront these data with what the people in court are claiming or saying.
So you have machinery, some sort of devices that shoot, well, I hope colored water in this case, not real blood. Or do you use real blood? I'm not sure, to simulate these things.
The answer is yes to the machine. So I'm a mechanical engineer. So we build machine that can produce blood spatters in very repeatable ways. And also, since we make those machines, we know exactly where the blood comes from because we can record with a high-speed camera the event. We know the position of the machine when we produce the blood spatter. And to your other question, we cannot use colored water because blood is a very complicated fluid. It's not colored water. It's a living thing. It has white blood cells. It has red blood cells. It has all kinds of coagulation agents. And these play a role during the creation of the blood drops, during their flight, during their impact on surfaces, and during the drying and formation of stains. So we use either our own blood, so we can prick our blood after being instructed by a nurse, or more commonly, we use horse blood.
So you have vats of horse blood or bottles of horse blood to use for this?
Yeah, so if you come in my lab, you open the fridge, you won't find sodas, but you will find a big red bottle of horse blood. And my students are forbidden to eat or drink in the lab. So we have a table outside where we have our coffee because we don't want to mix food with blood.
Why do you work with horse blood? Would pig blood be as good, or is horse blood actually very close to human blood?
Actually, horse blood is tastier to me than pig's blood.
What?
No, but seriously.
I was gasping there. No, yeah, this is okay.
The horse is more different biologically from the human than the pig is. And that means there's absolutely no risk to catch a disease from the horse blood, while there might be some risk working with pig's blood. So that's the main reason. Like I know that the horse blood is not a perfect model for the human blood. So what we're gonna do is, once we really want to make the experiment that's gonna confirm our theories, there we're gonna prick ourselves and use our own blood. But at the moment, it's convenient. And for example, my colleagues at Iowa State University in the Midwest Forensic Research Center, they also use horse blood. So I didn't really look very deep into this question. I use the same as what they've determined convenient and reasonable to use.
Daniel, someone listening to this film, we can be heard via the internet anywhere around the world. I'm imagining someone connected with Hollywood listening to this and saying, Daniel Attinger, he's the guy I want as an expert for my next, do you know the term, splatter film?
Well, yeah. I was a big fan of Tarantino movies in 1995, Pulp Fiction, and now I don't have much time to watch movies, but hey, if I can go to L.A., paid by a producer, anytime.
Okay.
You can find my phone number or email address on the internet.
Okay. Did you hear that, Quentin Tarantino? Daniel Attinger for your next film.
Well, I can learn from him, I'm sure.
I understand you also work with mouse traps. How do you do that?
Yeah, so mouse traps are cheap and very effective at atomizing blood. Imagine that instead of the mouse head or the piece of cheese, you put a couple of drops of blood. When you slam the mouse trap, you can project blood at several meters. So in my lab, we have a professionally engineered mouse trap that doesn't really look like the mouse trap you can buy in your local store. It's much heavier. It's made of materials that we can easily clean, and it's also more repeatable. And we use that to generate blood spatters.
Daniel Attinger is my guest, an associate professor of mechanical engineering at Iowa State University, who researches the area of blood stain pattern analysis. And you are, as well, your team, also working to develop portable tools that can be used at crime scene investigations that these investigators can use. Tell me about those.
So the principle is that as far as I know, from up to now, bloodstain pattern analysts, what they have done, they've been taking pictures on crime scenes to document the shape of the bloodstains. And those pictures, like I was saying, they make very well the difference between a round stain and an elliptical stain, and they allow you very precisely to determine the angle of impact. But to be able to reconstruct the curved trajectories of the blood, we need more than just the angle. We need also the size of the drop that created the stain, and also the velocity at which it impacted. And what we are working on is a tool that's going to make 3D measurements of the blood stains. In other words, we will have not only the shape that you can see on a photograph, but also the thickness of the drop. And from that thickness, we are now working hard on trying to figure out what was the size and the velocity of the drop that created the stain.
In working in this area, is it a dream of yours? Do you imagine one day that you and your team will be responsible for helping to find, to convict a killer, or perhaps free an innocent man or woman?
Actually, this is not a dream. This was a nightmare at the beginning. To be frank with you, I had sessions where I would be with a bloodstain pattern analyst who would take literally shoe boxes out of his shelves and show me pictures of things I wouldn't even dare describing. It was so horrible, suicide or mass murders, and very graphically described. So it was disturbing to me to be confronted with this, because I've never been personally on a crime scene, and I never had the dream to work on this. The way it happened is that I had done some significant work on drop impact and also drying of drops and creation of stains, but coffee stains. And at the time, I was also working on looking at wine stains to figure out if the wine was a Pinot or a Cabernet or a Syrah. I'm not at all fascinated by Dexter, and to be frank with you, I have no TV in my home.
You have seen Dexter or CSI, though, I assume.
I've seen one show when I was on a plane, and I believe I fell asleep.
because it was not very realistic, or why? Just because you were jet-lagged or something?
Yeah, probably the second one.
So this was not a case where you were... had forensic interests as a kid. You liked crime stories. You liked to hear about Sherlock Holmes and so forth.
No. I got interested in this after talking with cops and bloodstain pattern analyst. What I really like to hear is the psychological background. If you ask me if I'm fascinated by the difference between one gun and another type of gun, I would tell you that I've been a soldier in the Swiss Army, and what I know about guns is that it takes very long to clean those after you've shot. And I remember that my superiors, they would always tell me that my gun was not clean enough. So that's what I remember about guns.
What about, again, the possibility of your work, your team's work, serving justice, convicting a killer, freeing an innocent person because of something that you develop? What kind of feeling would that give you?
That would be a wonderful feeling, because the reason I studied engineering is not because I'm fascinated by machines, but it's because I'm convinced that engineering will bring the key answers to the issues that society has to deal with in the 21st century. For example, cleaning water, feeding people, producing energy, reducing pollution. And now if I'm helping the justice to keep innocent people out of jails and to catch the bad guys, I'll be extremely proud. And especially for me, I'm not a U.S. citizen. I'm an immigrant in this country. I've been very well received. And if I can contribute to this country by spending in a meaningful way the tax money of the residents of this country, I'll be extremely proud.
Daniel Attinger, Associate Professor of Mechanical Engineering at Iowa State University. It's been a real delight to hear about your work. Good luck on it. And it's not at all the blood-curdling conversation that I had imagined. Thank you.
My pleasure, Ben.
And when we come back after a short break, we'll continue with our hour looking at forensic research. Tyler O'Brien of the University of Northern Iowa will join us. O'Brien is a forensic anthropologist specializing in the study of underwater decomposition of bodies. That's when we return. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer with River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Today you're listening to an encore edition of the program. Now, if you tuned in our first half hour, you know we're talking about a couple of areas of forensic science this hour. Fascinating science, but be advised that it's also this half hour, it's not everyone's cup of tea, or lunch hour conversation, I guess would be more accurate in this case. This half hour, the forensics of decomposing bodies. Now, if a person dies, let's say in an area of isolated woods, the heart stops beating, a chemical transformation begins that we call rigor mortis. And then within hours, blood and skin cells start to decompose. Bacteria and scavengers are attracted. So what changes does a body go through if instead of on the ground, it's underwater. Our next guest is an expert in just that area. Tyler O'Brien is an associate professor of anthropology at the University of Northern Iowa. He has expertise in skeletal recovery and identification, has researched underwater decomposition, and has been a consultant for various law agencies in the Midwest. His work on evaluating human body decomposition has been published in the journal Forensic Sciences. And Tyler O'Brien, welcome to our program.
Good afternoon, Ben. Long-time listener, and I'm very pleased and honored to be a guest on the show. Thank you very much.
Thank you for being with us. Tell us, first of all, why study the decomposition of bodies underwater?
Well, it's just one natural environment in which we find human bodies when they go missing. I mean, there are a variety of contexts, fire scenes, underground, in a car. When I did my master's research down at Tennessee, one of the questions that was still open for discovery was finding out how long it takes a body to rot in a underwater context. And so I took that research on, and I was able to study that by looking at some bodies at a place called the Body Farm at University of Tennessee, Knoxville.
Mm-hmm.
That's the more colloquial term. They call it the Forensic Anthropology Research Facility, run by Dr. Bass. Why do you want to look at bodies underwater? Well, there's a remarkable transformation that occurs different than a body that is decomposing underground or a body that is decomposing on top of the ground.
Okay, so take us through, broadly speaking, we'll get into some of the details, some of your research later, but broadly speaking, what is the difference when the body is underwater?
Well, it can actually take a little bit longer than usual. Obviously, on top of the ground, a body, say, in the woods of Iowa in the month of June, say, right now, with the warm temperatures, on top of the ground, a body could be skeletonized in a period of about 1 to 2 weeks, depending on environmental conditions. And that's going to be the basic factor in any type of decomposition setting. But underwater, where we're talking about a body completely submerged in water, we're dealing with more of a process of actually preservation. The water tends to be a little bit colder. It inhibits bacterial growth. Although in the initial stages of death, soon after, the bacterial may still work to kind of bloat the body up, inflate the tissues because of them, the bacteria continuing to basically consume the inner body tissues. Basically, the lunch that we just ate is being aided in digestion by the bacteria in our guts. It's there. Okay, we have those things. And after we die, since we're no longer eating, those bacteria continue to do their job. And as they eat, they release gaseous waste, the smells of death, the sulfurs, the methanes, etc. And that gas will tend to bloat up a body, whether it's on land or underwater. And so that body, after about 5 to 7 days of bacterial growth, will float back up to the surface exposed. And so that's typically when bodies are rediscovered, either by a fisherman, hiker, or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
However, after a period of, say, floating on the surface, it may pop due to insect activity or predator activity and sink back down to the bottom of the environment, maybe a lake environment, a river environment, whatever. And it may last down there for quite some time. Like I was saying, underwater decomposition is a bit more of a preservation effect.
Mm-hmm.
Where a body in the woods would be skeletonized, a body in the water, that tissue, the fat and the skins and the chemistry of decomposition kind of transform the fat tissue into a thick, kind of denser material, a little bit like tofu or thick cream cheese, depending on how long after the body you find it.
I think you've just answered a question that I've had for a long time. For instance, I think, isn't it in sort of Tom Sawyer's book, other books too, they fire a cannon, for instance, is fired over a body of water where it is believed somebody has to drowned. And that fits in with what you've just described?
What are you referring to?
Well, to bring a body to the surface of a pond where there's a believed to be someone drowned, for instance.
Oh, you mean like the impact of the cannon to
yeah.
jostle the body free?
Maybe you haven't heard of this. I have.
No, I haven't.
Okay.
It's been a while since I've read Tom Sawyer.
Tell me more about the variables that can enter the picture and change the underwater decomposition process? Temperature and
temperature is the big one.
Temperature.
Salt water versus fresh water, mm-hmm. Clothing versus non-clothing. And when I did my study, all I could deal with at the time was just basic chemical transformation of the internal body tissues. I looked at fatty acids, et cetera. I had three naked human bodies that were donated to science, and I was able to test their rates of decay by watching them decompose in pools of water that I had dug in the ground for a period of about 6 or 7 months, I think it was.
Maybe. Is this here in Iowa or previously?
No, this was back in Tennessee when I was doing my master's research.
Okay, so none of this research taking place with bodies here in Iowa at the moment?
Not that I know of, no.
Okay. There's something mentioned in your paper called the Goldilocks phenomenon. What's that?
Oh, you read my work. You're one of them. You're the one who read my work. the Goldilocks phenomenon, I named after the children's story in reference to the whole just right kind of thing, that if the water temperature is too hot, then a body will tend to what's called macerate. It's kind of what we do to our turkey after Thanksgiving. We put in a pot of boiling water to make the meat kind of fall off the bones. And so if the water's too hot, the body will kind of liquefy. If the water is too cold, bacteria will never do anything. They will kind of die off or sporulate, turn into spores and just not do anything. And so you're left with just tissue that is not transforming at all. It's a cold, dark, watery environment, and it's not going to do anything. But if the water temperature is just right, called the Goldilocks phenomenon, and there's a certain range of temperature, depending, then the body will transform into this tissue called adipocere. Adipocere is a fatty, waxy substance where chemically there actually is no fat or no wax, but it's this denser, thicker tissue. And so what I was trying to test when I was doing my research was when you find a body, if you can quantify how much fatty acid is in the body, how much adipocere has transformed into, then you could more accurately determine the time since death. And that's one of the major questions that forensic anthropologists are trying to identify, mm-hmm. above and beyond the personal identification, age, race, sex, time, cause of death. It's time since death. The research that we had prior to some of my work was, positive identifications made of bodies that had been pulled out of water contexts in various states. We got, a body pulled up 5 months after death, positively identified. Okay, this is what adipocere looks like at 5 months. Another case, this is 2 years, this is 5 years. But nobody had ever really looked at the transformation of the tissue from day to day, and that's where my work came in.
Mm-hmm. Are you now, I know you do consulting for law agencies, are you consulted on specifically on these types of cases where they need to find out something about the body to solve
yes.
a question?
Yes, I am. I've worked, I won't give too many details, but I was consulted by a district attorney in Oklahoma, not recently, this was about 3 or 4 years ago, but on an underwater case of a young woman's body that was found in a 35-gallon drum in a small farm pond. And so I was called in to testify on that.
Mm-hmm. And what difference did your testimony make there?
It was a complicated case. Other things transpired, but my...
Having to do with the science, I guess.
Oh, was able to kind of corroborate what the medical examiner had found and assist in the district attorney's case and interpretation of time since death in relationship to the suspect.
Tyler O'Brien is my guest, if you've just joined us. Tyler O'Brien is an associate professor of anthropology at the University of Northern Iowa, a forensic anthropologist. He has expertise in skeletal recovery, identification, also has researched underwater decomposition of bodies. When you look at this area of forensic science, Tyler, what have we learned from this study, and where are the gaps in our understanding where you would say more study is needed?
Ooh, interesting. On just underwater or what?
Yes, let's stick with underwater for now.
Mm-hmm. Sure. There are a lot of questions that are still unanswered. Like I said, with some of the variables before, almost any other aquatic context, whether it's salt water versus fresh water. Okay, how long does it take a body to decompose or transform into adipocere off the coast of Puget Sound? And there's actually been some, you know, bodies that have been found in that context contribute to the literature. Or, you know, a cold mountain lake versus a swimming pool, which is chlorinated, versus a bathtub, which may be warm and hot. Actually, adipocere has been known to transform when a body has been wrapped in plastic and, you know, maybe hidden under the basement floor, something like that, because of the moisture that's still contained, whether a body is clothed or not. Perhaps even the quantity of fat on a body as well, one who's more corpulent versus one who's more lean. Those are some of the bigger questions that I was unable to answer with my early research that I hope new scientists will be able to uncover as the time progresses.
You also consult for law agencies for bodies, the skeletal recovery identification above ground or on the ground. Do you have a case or two that you can share with us that stand out in your memory as especially interesting?
Well, when you say body, that makes me kind of think that there's still going to be skin on it. Typically, as a forensic anthropologist, we're presented more with skeletal material, bones that have been out in the woods or something for a long period of time. Case that has stood out for in my mind. Let's see. There was an exhumation of a body. I'll try and be discreet. That needed to be identified because the markers on the tombstone had disappeared or were gone. And so they did not know who was in this tomb anymore. And so I was presented with a case to help kind of positively identify who this individual was and mark it up or match it up with some of the potential individuals. And this guy was remarkable. His skeleton showed incredible amounts of pathology or bone disease throughout his lower back. He had intriguing muscle markings on one side of his body, and that's one of the cool things that I like about this job is being able to match up a skeleton. Again, above and beyond the age, race, and sex stuff, you can look at muscle markings on the body. I mean, one who uses their right arm more and their right muscles are going to have a larger muscle attachments on the bone than in their left arm. Now, if you have a certain type of occupation, those muscle markings will be evident on the bones as well. And this guy showed heavy muscle markings in his lower arms and his upper legs, as if he had done a lot of work with his forearms and a lot of up and down activity, like kind of squatting up and or standing up and squatting down. Positive identification turned out that this guy was working in a flour mill. And so you can picture this guy kind of lifting up the old flour bags, putting him into a wheelbarrow, lifting it up with his legs. So being able to match that up with the age, race, and sex turned out to be a positive identification. Mm-hmm. That case sticks out in my mind.
Tyler O'Brien, when you think about your career and also earlier in your life, how did you come to specialize in this area? For instance, when you were young, now looking back, and many of us do this, you recognize this as an area that you were somehow moving toward.
You want a childhood story, huh?
There you go.
I actually have one. I remember the summer before I went off to, I think it was summer before I went off to college, bachelor's work. I saw a crow decomposing, a bird, a large bird, crow, decomposing on our front yard. And I went out there day after day and watched how the flies were attracted to the body. They laid their eggs. The maggots ate away at the flesh and the, you know, the crow's body kind of moving back and forth and just kind of tracked it visually over a period of a week. And when I was able to go to college and realize that I could study something like that, I majored in it and I focused on it for the rest of my career. And then I learned that I could actually do something helpful. What I've come to learn over time is that I'm not so much studying the dead for the dead's sake. I'm studying the dead for the living. That's who I'm helping. The living is what we're trying to do. The next of kin who want to know where their deceased relative is, when they who they are. Those forensic anthropologists that are helping to identify war dead, even from World War II, Vietnam era, those types of periods of time. Forensic anthropologists contribute a lot to the living.
Mm-hmm. Has this area of study made you think about your own body, your own death, what will happen with your own body, what you wish would happen with your body?
My post-mortem wishes?
There you go. Okay. Don't tell me you haven't thought about this.
Oh, I have, but I don't know if I want to contribute to it on live air. I think I'll go for cremation.
Why? You don't want to decompose.
No. I would prefer to... Wow. My students have asked me this question. I've never had such difficulty. I'd prefer cremation for the mere sake of kind of perhaps more environmental reasons,
mm-hmm.
that there is so little land left in the world that I don't think it needs to be taken up by a 6-foot pine box with my skeleton in it forever, that my ashes sprinkled across somewhere in the world would be nicer, more eco-efficient, so to say.
Gotcha.
And it's cheaper for my kids.
As we finish up here with our conversation, I want to ask you about a trip you'll be taking to Argentina, I believe, mm-hmm. this fall, researching a planned book about something called intentional head modification. We've got just a few minutes left, but tell us, what is that intentional head modification?
It's an ancient cultural practice by a number of groups around the world. My research is going to focus on those in South America that, as an infant, parents or the shaman would bind the infant's head with either boards or cords or something to reshape the developmental trajectory of the skull and subsequently the brain, I guess, to where you get what I guess more commonly known as cone heads or flat heads,
mm-hmm.
Sometimes referred to. Most archaeologists agree that this is some form of regional identification, that if I looked at your head, I could say, oh, you're from the highlands, or his head is from the lowlands, that kind of thing. Early archaeologists thought that it may be for some form of beauty. So I'm basically going to continue my data collection and my research down in South America, where you see many of these skulls, by writing a book on the subject of artificial cranial deformation or head modification.
And the open questions you'll be looking into are the questions that seem a little bit hazy in their answers?
Oh, the W's of journalism, the who, what, when, where, why, how, why, who cares, so what, those kinds of questions.
Mm-hmm. So parents, so
you'll have me back on when I write my book, and I'll be able to sell it, right?
Absolutely, we would love to have you back on. I'm just curious, as we finish up here, when you specialize in skeletal recovery, identification,
mm-hmm.
Body decomposition, I'm curious as to what sorts of reaction you get when you mention what you do at a gathering or at a party.
Oh, I was listening to it at the beginning when you were introducing me, saying that it's not dinner table talk. I'm not allowed to talk about my work at the dinner table or at home. My family doesn't like it. But I'm cautious about what I do. I try not to take it home with me, because that's too much of a mental and psychological burden with me. I deal with it through humor, as perhaps you've noticed in the interview already. But that doesn't mean I glamorize or romanticize death in any way. I deal with it in my own way, that way. But when I talk about it with folks, say at a whatever cocktail party or something, people like to learn about this kind of stuff. That's what really happens to a body after death. Wow.
Right. Well, we do have a fascination for it, as morbid as it is, don't we?
Indeed, we do. And I get students who come into my classes saying, listen, I really want to do what they do on TV. I watch that CSI show, the crime scene shows and all this. And I say, well, listen, you probably want to go over to the drama department, because they're all actors. You can't get DNA back in 45 minutes.
Okay. Tyler O'Brien, I truly wish we talk again after you've done some more research. Fascinating conversation. Tyler O'Brien, Associate Professor of Anthropology at the University of Northern Iowa. And he has been a consultant for various law agencies in the Midwest. His work has been published in the Journal of Forensic Sciences. Tyler O'Brien, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. It's been an absolute pleasure. Have a good afternoon.
You too. Take care.
Bye-bye.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Technical support from Dennis Reese. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Catherine Perkins. Podcasting and on-demand audio of River to River available by going to our website, iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music is written and performed by the River Monks, and you can contact us anytime with your comments and questions. River to River at iowapublicradio.org is our email. Once again, that's River to River at iowapublicradio.org. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us. Thank you.